is a sort of apocalyptic future that I'm painting here, and not one that I would wish our grandchildren to go into.
Climate change forecasts get gloomier. It's Thursday, October 27th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later in the show, we'll hear from the head of the UN's Environment Program about their new report showing a huge gap between what countries promised to do on climate change and what's actually happening. And a chat with Ghanaian musician King Promise. But first, we've been reporting this election season on how conspiracy theories about voter fraud are influencing local races and setting the stage for changes to election law in key states. Head to hereandnow.org for our stories from Wisconsin and Arizona. Today, Pennsylvania, where a close race for governor will determine who sets the rules around voting for future elections. Producer Sam Rafelson has our story.
Northampton is a battleground county in Pennsylvania, just north of Philadelphia. Last month, in an old classic theater, the local Republican Party hosted not a speech or a rubber chicken dinner, but a watch party.
Well, enjoy the movie. At the end, seriously, this young lady here will sign you up. We need poll watchers and poll workers.
The film is called 2,000 Mules, which has been widely discredited because it purports to document election fraud. The film features Dinesh D'Souza, a right-wing commentator who has long trafficked in conspiracy theories. His main argument is that cell phone tracking data and video suggest evidence of ballot mules. In other words, people who illegally haul multiple ballots to voter drop boxes and stuff them in.
Let me begin by asking a very simple question. Do we know the truth about what really happened in the 2020 election?
I think millions of Americans know something went wrong, and they have little pieces, and no one's really put it together. I'm
agnostic. By D'Souza's math, some 2,000 mules delivered 400,000 dodgy votes in 2020, enough to put Joe Biden over the top.
The 2020 election haunts the American mind.
We should note that data analysts in the film refuse to hand over evidence for their claims to lawmakers in Wisconsin or law enforcement in Arizona. But here in Pennsylvania, the film is convincing enough for some voters. Just ask Lisa Peters and Gene Walk.
Their evidence, what they brought forth, it's indisputable.
This isn't something Dinesh and these people made up. This is the truth of what happened. And you feel so cheated by it.
Chad Christman says he felt the film underscored the main issue that he believes mangled the 2020 election, voting by Dropbox or mail.
For those of us that have critical thinking, it didn't take much to connect the dots of COVID being the catalyst to start mail-in ballots, because without mail-in ballots, you don't have this.
These are all loyal supporters of Doug Mastriano. He's a Republican state senator running for governor. And in the Keystone State, the governor appoints the person who oversees elections. In a recent appearance on Newsmax, Mastriano suggests how he plans to use his governing power in the upcoming presidential election.
I get to appoint the Secretary of State, and the road to 2024 goes straight through Pennsylvania.
And if elected, he's vowed to purge voting rolls. Here's how he views drop boxes.
We have ample video footage. Now, these drop boxes, in my mind, are illegal, and I believe that compromised our election.
3 weeks after the 2020 election, as Donald Trump and his allies were contesting their loss in Pennsylvania, Mastriano chaired a faux hearing in Gettysburg with fellow Republicans.
And we're dealing with a government and leadership in Harrisburg that wants to close their ears to what's happened during this election, and sadly, many in the media that are complicit and want to write off what happened.
A month later, Mastriano spent more than $3,000 to bus Trump supporters to Washington, D.C. on January 6th. He's also considered by some as an extremist, most notably for his rhetoric about his Democratic opponent, Josh Shapiro, who is Jewish. If elected, Mastriano has said he'd appoint a woman as Secretary of the Commonwealth. And it's widely reported that a woman named Toni Shoup is a leading candidate. She's the founder of a group called Audit the Vote PA, which claims to be a nonprofit organization advocating for a free and fair election across the state. Here's Shoup speaking on the podcast, The Cannabis Conservative.
We know that the election was stolen, that there were all these anomalies, and now essentially what we have is proof from knocking on doors and specifics on the ground.
The question is, if Shoup or another election denier were in the job, how could she change how elections are run or decided? Dan Mallinson is a political scientist at Penn State Harrisburg.
If we're thinking of the presidential race, the Secretary of State certifies the vote and then it goes to the governor to sign off on the slate of electors that ultimately then meets and casts their ballots for the Electoral College. That's certainly a big way that a Secretary of State could hold up the process or refuse to certify.
The Secretary of State could also suggest that counties restrict the use of drop boxes or mail-in voting. Mallinson says all kinds of fringe things could arise that people haven't even thought of. For instance, the Secretary of State could decide to delay the counting of votes cast in the Democratic stronghold of Philadelphia.
In the past, I would have said that that would be crazy, right? But it's entirely possible if somebody's willing to put that kind of, I guess, chaos into the election process.
And Mallinson says an election decision could be thrown into the hands of state courts or lawmakers. Right now, Republicans hold a majority in both chambers of the state legislature.
Ultimately, a constitution or a set of statutes are words on a piece of paper. They don't enforce themselves. It requires willing and good actors to do the right thing for that system to function well and for people to have confidence in it.
Confidence. It's something that voters across Pennsylvania have already indicated they are losing in both the election process and the people who run them.
Okay, you're in downtown Allentown, and this is the Lehigh County Government Center.
Phillips Armstrong runs the local elections here. A county judge recently threw out a request by a Republican advocacy group hoping to limit the use of drop boxes. But the headwinds remain. Since 2020, Armstrong says election board members in more than half of Pennsylvania's 67 counties have left.
And the reason is we get threats, we get people, you know. We're not here that. We're here to make sure it's a verified, correctly done, and there's been no misinformation.
Armstrong says he's received threats himself. So has Al Schmidt. He's the former Republican commissioner of Philadelphia. When the 2020 results in Pennsylvania were being contested, Trump blamed him. Schmidt has since left public office and is now the president of a nonpartisan nonprofit called Committee of 70.
I think the more troubling thing with it is that the longer people believe in these lies, the harder I think it'll be to bring them around to reality.
And the reality is, these claims of election fraud in Pennsylvania are widely discredited, namely by Jim Martin. He's the Republican district attorney of Lehigh County.
It's almost ludicrous to attack, in my opinion, attack drop boxes when essentially you got hundreds of them throughout Lehigh County. They're called mailboxes. I would say that, you know, in Lehigh County, we haven't uncovered, I called it a smoking gun, we haven't uncovered any fraud as a result of it. I don't think there has been any.
Mastriano's Democratic opponent, Josh Shapiro, says if elected, he'll appoint a, quote, pro-democracy Secretary of State to protect mail-in voting. Here he is on MSNBC.
And I believe here in Pennsylvania, we have a unique responsibility to defend our democratic institutions and the very democracy that all of this progress we need to make is laid upon.
Just like 2020, Pennsylvania will be front and center in November's midterms. State election rules don't allow workers to start counting mail-in ballots until the morning of Election Day, so results will likely be late again. Political scientist Dan Mallinson says that presents a golden opportunity to sow disinformation, which slowly erodes democracy.
It's also important to be sober because democracies do die, right? And they do crumble. And so there's a lot of vigilance required to maintain democracy.
Something Pennsylvania voters will have to consider in electing their next governor, ultimately deciding the future of their state's elections. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Rafelson.
After the break, governments are failing to deliver on their promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A new UN report says we're running out of time to prevent a climate catastrophe. Stick around. The commitments that countries have made to reduce CO2 emissions are nowhere near enough to prevent some of the worst effects of climate change. And the window for action is closing. A new United Nations report shows that the Earth is on a path to warm 2.8 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, and only a complete system-wide transformation will lower the temperature. Inger Andersen is executive director of the UN Environment Program, which published the report. She spoke to Celeste Headley.
So reading this report is upsetting. but I have to say, that's true of nearly every climate report that has come out over the past decade. Slowing down climate change begins to seem impossible. COP27, the United Nations Climate Change Conference that comes up in November, will probably have to deal with some very sobering news. What kind of action needs to be taken at this point?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is sobering news, and every report that has come out has come with quite stark numbers, and that's no different here. We're heading right now to a 2.8 degree world, and we can take some actions that we've promised, and we think we've made a big dent, but we've actually only, then we will arrive at 2.6 degree world by 2100. So there is a long way to go. What has to happen is systems shift. So what does that really mean? Well, it means that in the electricity sector, which accounts for nearly half at 42% of all energy-related emissions, we need to shift that to zero carbon power. We need to get to an increase of renewable in the energy sector. And I'm speaking globally, of course. And the transport sector, similarly so. That's the second largest source of energy-related CO2 emissions. And here we need to ensure that we invest in e-vehicles and, of course, that we invest in public transport as well. Similarly for building sector, you know, this is an obvious one and just one for the picking. And it's so frustrating that countries haven't done that yet. Because let's think about it. We're already regulating for earthquakes and fires and so on. Why can't we regulate for energy intensity? And then there are the food systems where we need to be sure that we have lesser emissions from organic, rotting food. And of course, industry itself. So these are the areas, but let's think about it this way. Doing these actions will create great economic growth. And so we just need to reach for it and not be beholden to the past.
Well, since you brought up the economy, the global financial system, it appears, is a big part of the problem. Last year, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said our financial system was fueling environmental destruction. Let's take a listen.
When you destroy a forest, you are creating GDP, according to the statistics. When you overfish, you are increasing your GDP, according to the statistics. When you destroy the planet, you are, in the statistics, you are showing an increase of GDP. So even that needs to be changed.
So explain how that might work. I mean, when you talk about transformation, changing the way we define economic success is a massive shift.
Yes, it is. But we understand that short-term profits drive growth, but we're not taking into account how that is, in a way, sawing over the very branch on which we are sitting. Because what we want is vibrant ecosystems that can actually deliver harvests and food. What we want is vibrant fisheries where we don't fish the oceans empty. And what we want is obviously forests that are vibrant, deliver timber and products that we need, but not at the expense of being carbon sinks. And so rethinking GDP and rethinking nature as an asset class, just like we consider labor an asset class, these are the kind of things that we need to rethink. And I will say that already some banks in some countries and some central bank regulators have begun to deal with this and understand that a banking sector that has invested heavily in hydrocarbon is not a safe banking sector. And so doing these health checks and stress tests on our banks and on our financial system so that we do not enter into a climate-related financial crisis 20 years from now when we see that these assets are no longer producing the value that we thought they would.
How do you deal, as the United Nations, how do you deal with the inequity of not only which nations are producing the most emissions, including the United States, and which nations are doing the most to cut back on emissions and take actions to fight climate change?
It is a clear issue of inequity and climate injustice. the 20 largest economies are responsible for 75% of global emissions. And so if these 20 economies lean in and do the right thing, actually, we are a long, long way towards the solution.
Last question for you. Many of us are already noticing and becoming concerned because we can see the effects of climate change. But I wonder if you could just explain what it means if the planet were to warm 2.8 degrees by the end of the century. What would that look like?
It's actually a future that's very hard to fathom, but it would mean that the kind of wildfires, the kind of droughts, the kind of inundations, the ferocity of the storms that we have been seeing will be greater, more frequent, and with greater intensity and damage. People will have to move from low-lying areas. Property would no longer have value in a number of places. And we will see at the global scale significant people movement, climate migrants, climate refugees. And some places would become uninhabitable. And so it is a sort of apocalyptic future that I'm painting here, and not one that I would wish our grandchildren to go into.
Inger Andersen is the executive director of the UN Environment Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next. Deepa Fernandez and Chico Theory recently got a plum assignment. Go check out a show by King Promise, a star of the growing Afrobeats music scene. And if you have no idea what Afrobeats means, don't worry, we'll cover that too. That's after the break.
A genre of music from Ghana and Nigeria is taking the world by storm. It's called Afrobeats.
Baby, calm down, calm down. Yo, this your body, it puts in my heart for lockdown, for lockdown.
This is Rema and Selena Gomez performing a remix of his song called Calm Down. It's one of four songs featuring Afrobeats artists on the Billboard Hot 100. While the genre has been a big hit in Africa and even the UK, it's still gaining traction among US audiences. Earlier this year, Burna Boy became the first Nigerian to sell out Madison Square Garden. And in June, Fireboy DML became the first Afrobeats artist to perform at the BET Awards. Some of you may be thinking, wait, the late Nigerian musician Fela Kuti and his music have long been appreciated here. But that's Afrobeat, which became popular in the 1970s. This new genre adds an S. It's Afrobeats. We asked Ghana-based music writer Sarah Osei to describe what it is.
It's definitely much more than a sound. It's a culture, it's a movement. It is the moment right now. And for a lot of Africans, whether that's in the diaspora or the continent, I think it's the first time that we feel seen and heard on such a global stage.
One of the genre's rising stars is 30-year-old Ghanaian singer Gregory Newman, known by the stage name King Promise. He just wrapped up his first US tour. Earlier this month, I caught up with him during soundcheck, right before his show in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was like a private show before the real show. He hops off stage and we sit down for a chat. King Promise, welcome to NPR.
Thank you for having me. You know, our link up is way overdue.
You are from Accra, Ghana.
Yes.
And that is debatably where Afrobeats was born.
Yeah, exactly. Our core sound is high life. You want to move your body when you hear high life. It's very melodic and also makes you move your feet. So that's what it is.
You know, I hear a lot in Afrobeats and in your music, particularly high life. Also some hip-hop influences, some R&B,
high life, and hip-hop. I'm from the ends, I'm from the streets, so we love hip-hop. Back home in Ghana, hip hop is big as well. And I try to be the balance between the old school and the new school and everything that's going on. So I sing about everything. I sing about money, the streets, the come up, and a lot about love. You know what I mean? Afrobeat is mostly about love. That's what we sing. We Africans, we like love, man. So.
Well, Chico and I, senior producer of this show, we were just standing listening to you, and it really struck me that there's a lot of love in your songs.
Yeah, that's it. Like I like singing what the people love to hear, and you know, spread good energy. You know what I mean? If I'm not talking about chopping life, which means having fun, then I'm talking about, you know, loving one another and, you know, being there for each other.
I mean, in the same way that hip hop kind of is the voice of realities that, you know, might be hard, does Afrobeats touch on that kind of stuff? Are you talking about what's, you know, what's real?
Yeah, of course. My core thing is to make music where all I have is my truth, and I sing that through my music. And being the mouthpiece of the people, you have to make sure you're saying something that they can actually, you know, relate to and, you know, find themselves in the music. And that's my thing, you know.
So what music did you come up listening to? Well, what's your influence to now be kind of blending all these genres into this new one that's taken the world by storm?
That's the thing. It's a blend of different genres. My dad, I can say, is the one who's, you know, it's his fault this is happening right now. He played a lot of music when I was growing up. Daddy Lumba, Foreign Ponson. These are Ghanaian greats when I was growing up. And apart from that, there was a lot of boy band music in my house, Backstreet Boys, Westlife, all of that. And then he loves reggae, so there's Bob Marley, there's the Lucky Dube, Buju Banton, Peter Tosh, and then there's rap.
And isn't Chance the Rapper on, aren't you collaborating with him?
Yes, me and Chance the Rapper collaborated on my new album called Five Star. We have a song called Run To You.
She hit my number, call my phone, text me when I'm coming home. I miss you to my baby, I go see you in a minute, I did come to you. And maybe I did run to you now.
So what does your dad think of the music you're making now, given that he kind of raised you on a bunch of different things?
Nah, he's proud, you know. My dad is a superstar now. When you go to the hood, that's Kim Promise's dad. Even he's Kim Promise, not me. He's famous now, so I think he likes it. Yeah.
Afrobeats has gone global. You know, it's obviously huge in Ghana, Nigeria, and the UK. What about here in the US?
It's a journey we're embarking on, you know, like even me coming here, it's my first time, do you know what I mean? Coming to Boston and to do a show. Most of the shows on my tour, I've never been to these places. But the good thing is now you, in America, you turn on the radio and you hear at least 4 Afrobeat songs. It wasn't like that before, do you know what I mean? So it means it's working. Like we're literally slow but surely, just the way it broke into the UK and Europe, we're bringing it here because the sound is so beautiful. We don't want to be selfish. You want to share it with the rest of the world. And like I said, you don't need to even understand what we're saying to love it. The music is just orgasmic to your ear. So everyone, Afrobeats is all about happy vibes. You know what I mean? Even when we're singing about sad stuff, you still want to get up and dance, you know?
When you were a kid growing up in Accra, did you think that this might be your future?
Nah. I never thought we'd be here today, you know, like, I had different dreams coming, like growing up. I never thought I'd be an artist. I went to uni. I have a BSc in business administration. My major was marketing. So there was no way I was going to do a 9-to-5 because it's not for me. But I had to get a degree because I love education. And I had to do it for my parents as well. If you're African, you'd understand this. We have to get the degree for our parents. And also, I wanted it, like I said, for myself. But eventually, I stumbled on making music. My dream to take over the world with the music, our sound, and represent Ghana to the world through our sound, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
You know, just finally, I think that the idea of representing Ghana, it's not a country that we hear that much about in the news here in the United States, let alone for the cultural scene. So to just end by taking us on into your Accra, and the cultural scene that you're a part of.
Ghana is the most beautiful place you could ever be at on this planet. And Ghana is like the gateway to Africa. We have like amazing food, the most hospitable people you can ever like meet. The nightlife is wild. And culturally, we are very heavy on where we are from, you know, so come to Ghana. Yeah, man.
King Promise, thank you so much for taking time out of your Boston show to talk to us.
Thank you for having me. I'm having a good time. I hope you had a good one.
With that, we posed with King Promise for a selfie, and then it was showtime. His fans huddled closer to the stage, camera phones high above their heads, singing their hearts out, letting their Afrobeat star know how thrilled they were that he was there. And now that Afrobeats has made its way to the main stage here, what now? Again, music writer Sarah Osei.
I think Afrobeats has proven it has the potential to go very far. You know, there's talk about the Grammys adding an Afrobeats category, or you see an Afrobeats chart in the UK, but having a hit, having a TikTok challenge go viral, it's not enough. We need labels, we need publishers, distributors, the whole system should be set up by Africans, for Africans, for this really, truly be a global movement. Because right now, we're still guests in a lot of these spaces.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. If you like anything you've heard on this podcast, we'd love it if you told a friend about Here and Now anytime. And we'd like it even more if you rated us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps the show grow. And thanks. As always, there's so much more to read and listen to at our website, hereandnow.org. New today, we've got conversations with Chef Cartier Brown about her cookbook, and author Jonathan Escoffrey discusses his debut short story collection, If I Survive You.
You rarely see Caribbean people like them in books or on TV. It's always a kind of narrative about poverty and how the U.S. saved people. And I wanted to take a closer look at that.
Today's stories were produced by Sam Rafelson, Julia Corcoran, and Ashley Locke, with help from Chico Fayoti and Kalyani Saxena. Gabe Bullard and Peter O'Dowd edited the show. Our technical directors are Max Liebman and Patrick O'Connor. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.